estimate, and a number, the true number, is closer to 160. The Indonesian Pediatrician Association chairman, Dr. Aman Pulungan, told the ABC in June, "It proves that it is not true that the under 18 age bracket is not susceptible to COVID-19. In India, not only have children been left orphaned due to the high COVID-19 death rate, but the devastating second wave is seeing more children infected. While child mortality is still low overall, they are being hit more severely." Dr. Srikanta JT, a pediatric pulmonologist working in Bangalore, India, says during the previous wave of COVID, there might be one child a week with COVID. He tells The Guardian newspaper, "But according to data from most health centers in India and our own data collected over the last few months, the second wave seems to be impacting children quite significantly, with numbers gradually increasing with almost 12 to 15 positive cases a day. These include young children and adolescents. While most children seem to have asymptomatic to mildly infections, which could be managed at home, there is a growing number of severe cases in children." Dr. Srikanta JT added, "We're also witnessing a significant number of severe cases, like severe pneumonia requiring ventilatory support to children presenting with type 1 diabetes mellitus and complications of it like diabetic ketoacidosis to multi-system inflammatory syndrome with significant morbidity and mortality. Even though it quantifies to approximately 5% of our cohort, the numbers are quite significant. As well as the role of underlying conditions that are more common in children living in harsh conditions, Dr. Srikanta says once lockdowns and other restrictions were lifted following the first wave of coronavirus, there was a sense in the general public that the pandemic was behind them," he says, "and most started either completely or partially refraining from COVID-appropriate behavior," adding, "This inappropriate behavior has led to significant intermingling and hence a second wave of the virus." A theory as to why children generally appear less susceptible to the coronavirus than adults is that they have less of a type of receptor known as ACE2 in their respiratory tract. These receptors are a key pathway for the entry of the virus that causes COVID-19 to enter human cells. It is theorized that fewer ACE2 receptors means fewer opportunities for the virus to take hold. Dr. Srikanta says, "During the first wave of the pandemic, it was generally thought that both absence and reduced numbers of these receptors in children was generally protective," adding, "But along came the second wave with a more virulent strain, which seems to bypass the apparatus required for entry and evade the immune system better, hence an increase in both numbers in children and severity in infection." The latest World Health Organization COVID-19 epidemiological report says the highest numbers of new cases reported in the week to 11th of May were from India, where 2,738,957 new cases, a 5% increase, was reported, followed by Brazil, where 423,438 new cases was reported, similar to the previous week. Indonesia had the third highest number of new cases in the Southeast Asia region, behind India and Nepal, with 36,882 new cases reported, a 2% increase under week prior. Robert Boy, a professor of pediatrics and child health at the University of Sydney in Australia, says the sheer population size of those countries is also likely behind the higher cases in children there. He says whether variants or other mechanisms, such as the one involving ACE2 receptors described by Dr. Srikanta, are driving the rates in children needs more study. He says, "As this virus keeps mutating, it carries the risk of becoming much more transmissible, which is the primary thing we've noticed in the last 6 months, but it may actually become more severe for children." He added, "We just don't know everything there is to know yet."
6 p.m. Washington time.
Part 3.
In September 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was really concerned about peace and security in the world, invited the two sides of a major conflict to a meeting. His guests were Anwar al-Sadat, president of Egypt, and former fighter, the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin. After 30 years of fruitless Arab-Israeli wars, both sides preferred to talk secretly about the conflict for a few days. The secret talks needed a comfortable place, and it was situated in Washington Northwest Road on top of the forested hills. It was Camp David, the country retreat for the President of the United States. It is a place filled with trees, good weather, and also important secrets. Of course, this was not the first time that the United States held itself accountable for Israel. Jimmy Carter was not the only one who had this sense of responsibility in U.S. government. The first and perhaps most responsible U.S. president on the Palestinian issue was Harry S. Truman. The most important place to express this sense of responsibility was in the United Nations General Assembly to divide Palestine into two independent states, Arab and Jewish. It was possible to create a nation with the vote of the majority and give them land in the same place.
Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no.
The next Arab-Israeli dispute was over a waterway built in 1869 in Egypt. This canal connected Port Said on the Mediterranean coast to the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. This waterway later became known as the Suez Canal. The canal was built so that ships traveling from the west to the ports of the east of the world would not have to go around the African continent.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
what
a situation
do you want the
of
United
law.
States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
Lyndon B. Johnson, then President of the United States, told Eben that he did not want Israel to start a war. During this meeting, Johnson read part of the secret document to Eben. The document stated that Israel will not be alone unless it decides to go alone. The Soviet Union said the same words to Egypt and urged them not to start a war. In practice, however, Egypt did start the war by closing the Strait of Tiran to Israel. Forty-five minutes later, the runways of the Egyptian military airports were bombed and all the Egyptian fighters were targeted by Israeli rockets on the ground without even having a chance to start their engines. The Egyptian Air Force was completely destroyed. The Syrian and Jordanian air forces were also hit by these surprise attacks. Sinai Desert, Egyptian tanks were three times more than Israeli tanks, but there was no air cover for the Egyptian ground forces. The U.S. envoy saw the Israeli representative at the lobby and gave him the message.
United States Ambassador Goldberg asked me to come out into the lobby and to say to me, you must immediately announce that the fighting is over.
But this was not within the power of the Israeli ambassador to the UN. The Israeli representative talked to Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eben about the issue. Eben immediately called Eshkol's house to tell him that the international pressure had increased and he had to stop the war as soon as possible at the request of the US. On October the 6th, 1973, as the Zionists were waking up to prepare for the festival, they were hit by surprise attacks on two fronts of Sinai and the Golan Heights, the same areas occupied by Israel in the Six-Day War in 1967. Inevitably, the Israeli tanks started attacking, but the Egyptians had thought about that too. The Sagar anti-tank missile made Sinai a graveyard for Israeli tanks. Sagar anti-tank guided missiles were again the result of Egyptian friendship with the Soviet Union. In the first 36 hours of the war, half of the 300 Israeli tanks stationed in Sinai were destroyed. But at the same time, the conflict started on the northern front in the Golan Heights on Syrian territory. Six hours later, the Israeli firing line was broken and Syrian tanks were close to the Jordan River. That night, the southern half of the Golan Heights was captured by the Syrians. Chief of Staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, David El-Azhar, announced at a news conference that the Israeli counterattack had begun.
This morning, we started our counterattack, and we shall break and destroy completely all the attacking forces.
Sinai Desert witnessed Israelis heavy losses again. The fact was that Israel had lost the ability to resist on both the eastern and northern fronts. El-Azhar had to choose a front for his forces to concentrate on. The Egyptians had advanced in the Sinai Desert, but they still saw the desert for miles before their eyes. But Assyrians had advanced to the banks of the Jordan River and were not far from the villages and towns bordering Israel. So El-Azhar prepared the concentration of forces on the Golan Heights. In the night of October the 8th, 1973, Israeli tanks reached Syrian positions in the Golan Heights, but the Soviet Union's modern infrared night combat equipment inflicted horrific casualties on the Zionists. The Israelis knew that defeat on the Golan Heights could come at a heavy price. Destruction. On October the 10th, the Israelis took control of the Golan Heights, and their tanks forced the Syrians to retreat. The Israelis were now just 30 kilometers from Damascus. Hafez al-Assad asked Sadat to do something to take the pressure off the Syrians. At this point, Anwar al-Sadat made a serious and decisive decision. He ordered his troops stationed in the Sam missile line in the east of the Suez Canal to go to nearby heights in the Sinai Desert. But to reach these heights, the tanks had to leave the area covered by some missiles. This operation marked one of the largest tank battles in history. Israeli tanks with better strategic positions targeted the Egyptian tanks. The Egyptians' tanks, on the other hand, were out of the safe zone of some missiles, and the Israeli fighters could attack them easily. Egyptian tanks were destroyed, but the Zionists lost only 20 tanks. The war reached its critical moment. Israel had stopped its enemies, but could no longer resist. Finally, Golda Meir's plans had worked. Golda Meir had called for immediate assistance from the United States from the beginning of the war and after Israel's successive defeats on the East and North fronts. As a result, on October the 15th, 1973, the largest arms shipment in history was sent to Israel, as ordered by President Nixon. Israel benefited from this flood of arms in the war.
There was no doubt in my mind, no doubt in Henry Kissinger's mind, as to what we should do. Israel had to be saved.
One of Israel's most brutal military commanders was called up after the arrival of American weapons. The man who knew the Sinai Desert very well, Ariel Sharon. To go over the Suez Canal, he decided to open a canal to the west coast of the Suez Canal between the two divisions guarding it. Egyptians did not take care of the area near Lake Al-Moura due to the greater width of the lake than other parts of the canal. And there was a distance of about a mile between the watchful forces in the north and south of the canal. The Israelis could have dominated the Egyptians by crossing this route from behind. Something was wrong. Sharon did not think about the talent of the Egyptian forces stationed near Lake Al-Moura. The Israeli forces entered the canal at night, but most of them clashed with the Egyptians because the Egyptians near the lake were more powerful than what Sharon had imagined, so only a few of them were able to cross the canal. Year before, when the Israelis had thought of such a day, they had built a 180-meter-long bridge just to cross the Suez Canal in such a situation. It took 3 days to install the bridge. On October the 19th, when the bridge was completely installed, the Egyptians were astonished. Israeli tanks crossed the bridge and took up positions on the west coast of the Suez Canal, just behind the Egyptians. Egypt opened heavy fire on the Israelis, but the Israelis were thinking of only one thing, the Sam rocket launchers. The Suez sky became safe for Israeli fighters when SAM missiles were targeted by Israeli tanks. The flood of American weapons of the Israeli army engulfed the Egyptians. The Israelis began to advance into Egypt, and Anwar al-Sadat had no choice but to call a ceasefire. At that time, Egypt's powerful ally, the Soviet Union, played its role. The Soviet leader, Leonid Brezhnev, who had previously shown his forces to the United States, threatened the U.S. with sending Soviet troops to the region if Washington did not agree to send a joint U.S.-Soviet peacekeeping force to the Middle East. The United States was almost certain that the Soviet Union would not send troops to the Middle East, but nevertheless prepared its nuclear weapons. And the Soviet Union were afraid of a nuclear war, and this fear brought peace back to the Middle East, and a ceasefire was reached on October the 25th to allow tired soldiers to retreat. But something happened that surprised Israel and even Sadat himself. When you are forced to do something, you will forget the Arabic zeal for not recognizing Israel. 4 years after the Yom Kippur War on November the 19th, 1977, after years of war between the Arabs and Israel, Anwar al-Sadat, who was no longer able to fight Israel, changed his way completely. He was the first Arab president to land at Ben Gurion Airport with U.S. support and spoke of reconciliation and peace at the Israeli Knesset.
Let us agree that whatever happens between us, we should solve it together through, talks rather than going to war.
But they had to have a meeting in a cozy place, Washington Northwest Road, on top of Jungle Hills, U.S. President's exclusive resort, Camp David. Days of secret talks at Camp David led to a treaty that was signed by both sides the following year in the open courtyard of the White House in Washington. Then U.S. President Jimmy Carter was happy and satisfied.
Provides for the full exercise of Egyptian sovereignty over the Sinai. It calls for the full withdrawal of Israeli forces from the Sinai. And after an interim withdrawal, which will be accomplished very quickly, the establishment of normal, peaceful relations between the two countries, including diplomatic relations.
Sadat recognized Israel, while Gamal Abdel Nasser and the rest of the Arab leaders said, no peace with Israel, no recognition of Israel, no negotiations with Israel in the Khartoum summit. Instead, Israel returned the Sinai Desert to Egypt without the slightest conflict. Diplomatic relations were established between Egypt and Israel, and Israeli ships were able to cross the Suez Canal, the Gulf of Aqaba, and the Strait of Tiran freely. It seemed like a good deal. Sadat also won the World Peace Prize for his good deal and became the symbol of world reconciliation. But the last deal was not that good. 3 years later, on October the 6th, 1981, the Nobel Peace Prize winner was shot by a young man who was shouting, either death or compromise. Egyptian people and the Arabs who were dissatisfied with the peace between Egypt and Israel, Khalid Islamboli thanked Anwar al-Sadat for the deal with Israel.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. 2 years after Ronald Green, a 49-year-old black man from Louisiana, died after a confrontation with white police officers in May of 2019, the Louisiana Police Department has finally released footage of the incident. Louisiana State Police had refused to publicly release video footage from the incident, which they claimed culminated in Ronald Green dying from crashing into a tree and injuring his head. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Lauren Aratani. The piece is titled, Ronald Green Punched and Dragged by Police Before His Death, Video Shows. Stay with us for more of Lauren Aratani's article. Years after Ronald Green, a 49-year-old black man from Louisiana, died after a confrontation with white police officers in May of 2019, the Louisiana Police Department has finally released video footage of the incident. Louisiana State Police had refused to publicly release video footage from the incident, which they claimed culminated in Ronald Green dying from crashing into a tree and injuring his head. Video footage released by the police on Friday, 21st of May, was similar to the video released by the Associated Press this past week, which showed inconsistencies with the police's claim that Ronald Green had died from a car crash. It is unclear how the Associated Press obtained the video footage. The videos taken from body and dashboard cameras from the officers on the scene showed the disturbing encounter that Ronald Green had with the police that night. Police officers started to pursue Green for an unspecified traffic violation just after midnight. Officers are seen punching Green and using a stun gun whilst he's on the ground. At one point during the video, Ronald Green pleads with the officers. He says, "I'm your brother. I'm scared. I'm scared." The police officers on the scene are heard calling him an obscenity and using expletives, and dragged him face down on the ground after handcuffing him. Ronald Green's family said police told them he had died after his car crashed during a police pursuit. Police later adjusted the story and said he had struggled with police officers and died on his way to hospital. No cause of death was mentioned in Ronald Green's autopsy report. Two investigations, an internal inquiry from Louisiana police, and a federal civil rights investigation began at the end of last summer, over a year after Ronald Green's death in May of 2019. Green's family has also filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the police officers involved in the case. Citing these investigations, police refused to release video footage and body cam footage until last Friday. Colonel Lamar Davis, the state police superintendent, said the agency decided to release the video footage to encourage healing. "I want the public to move towards healing. This has been a tragic event. When we look at Mr. Green's family and all they're going through, what I don't want is for this to keep resurfacing and bringing up old wounds," he said at a press conference. Mona Hardin, Ronald Green's mother, told CNN that she was disgusted by the videos which had just been released. "There's no words for how mad I am." Ron Haley, the lawyer for Green's family, said the video's release was 2 years too late, but better late than never, according to The Advocate, a local newspaper. There could have been an investigation that was immediately opened, but the family was also lied to that he died in a car crash. "If you're going to investigate yourself and give the family no reason for his death, hoping they don't look into it, it's never going to come out," he said. Davis, the police chief, said he intends to fire one of the state troopers involved in the case, according to The Advocate. A second trooper died in a car crash last year, shortly after he was informed of his imminent termination. A third police officer received a 50-hour suspension.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Mm-hmm. message to the Palestinian nation for their victory over the Zionist regime, May 21st, 2021.
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, my greetings to the powerful, oppressed Palestine. Greetings to the brave, zealous Palestinian youth. Greetings to the heroic, resistant Gaza. Greetings to Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and all jihadi and political groups in Palestine. I thank God, the Almighty, for granting his assistance and for the honor he has bestowed on the Palestinian fighters. I ask God, the Beneficent, to bestow tranquility and peace of mind on the injured hearts of the bereaved, to shower his mercy and glad tidings on the martyrs, and to completely heal the wounded. I also extend my congratulations on this victory against the criminal Zionist regime. The recent test over these few days has honored the Palestinian nation. The savage, wolf-like enemy has realized correctly that it is powerless when facing the unified uprising of Palestine. This test, the cooperation between Quds and the Western Bank with Gaza and 48 territories and Palestinian camps, has shown the future solution to the Palestinians. Over the past 12 days, the violent regime committed immense crimes, especially in Gaza. They have proven in practice that it can behave so shamelessly and idiotically as a result of its incapability in confronting the unified uprising of the Palestinians that it provokes the public opinion of the world against itself. They have added to the hatred against themselves and the Western governments that support it, in particular the criminal US. The continuation of their crimes and their request for a true meaning and the request for a truce mean the defeat of the Zionists. The Zionists were forced to accept defeat.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine.
The malicious regime will become even weaker. The preparedness of the Palestinian youth, the show of power by valuable jihadi groups, and a continual increase in the elements of power will make Palestinians stronger day by day, and it will render the uprising enemy weaker and more despicable with each passing day. The time to begin and to end the clashes depend on the discernment of the great jihadi and political leaders of Palestine. But being prepared and maintaining a powerful presence in the field cannot be stopped. The experience in Sheikh Jarrah in resisting the aggression of the regime and the mercenary inhabitants of the settlements should become a perpetual plan of action for the courageous people of Palestine. I salute the valiant youth of Sheikh Jarrah. The entire world of Islam has responsibilities and religious obligations with respect to the Palestinian cause. Political common sense and experience in ruling and governing confirm and put emphasis on this religious edict. Muslim governments should earnestly enter the field to support the Palestinian nation in both military and financial areas, which is needed more than the past, and to help in rebuilding infrastructures and the ruins in Gaza. The nation's demanding and pursuing this matter is a source of support for this religious and political call. Muslim nations should demand that their governments carry out their duties. Nations themselves have the responsibility to provide financial and political support as much as they are able to. Another important responsibility is pursuing the matter of the publishment of the terrorist, bloodthirsty Zionist regime. All conscientious people in the world agree that the widespread crime of massacring Palestinian children and women over the past 12 days should not remain unpunished. All of the regime's agents who were involved in this crime and the criminal Netanyahu himself should be prosecuted and punished by independent international courts of law. And this will surely happen with God's power. And Allah has command of His affairs. Holy Quran, chapter 12, verse 21.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are going to discuss Imam Khomeini's view on death. Death has always been one of the, if not the most, mysterious and unknown phenomenon in the world. According to biology, death is the end of life. And according to medicine, it means the irreversible stop of vital signs. Once the heart stops functioning, senses are lost, and a living creature doesn't feel anything. It cannot hear, see, taste, or smell. Death has been paid attention in all divine and non-divine religions. Christians believe that the entire mankind will die and a new world will come to existence. Jews also believe in death, but there are different beliefs among Jews on the life after death. Most of them have the same opinion on resurrection. Indeed, the belief in resurrection is one of the basic tenets of Judaism, and denial of it is considered as a big sin. Zoroastrianism, too, believes in death. According to the Zoroaster, as soon as the spirit is separated from the body, the owner of the spirit will be judged on the life and what he or she has done in life. The diseased person will be interrogated. Then his deeds will be personified as the symbol of good thought, good word, and good deed. Altogether, human beings have not been able to deny death. However, the divine religions have tried to warn mankind on the reality of death and the fact that human being will see in the hereafter the result of whatever he has done in this world. According According to Islam, death is a bridge for going from this world to the unseen world. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says that the life of this world is like sleep, while death is waking up. It means that death acts like a gate to exit the world of imagination and entering the world of reality. The Noble Quran says that death is a process to transfer man from one stage to another. It is like the phenomenon of turning a worm into a butterfly. It is metamorphosis. According to the Islamic teachings, human beings experience death every time that they sleep. But it is a kind of death that is a return. In other words, every night we die and the next morning we are revived. The Noble Quran says that every creature will taste death. The soul leaves the body by death. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, believed that death is a transition from the apparent mundane phase to the inward ephemeral phase. This Gnostic description shows that death is not destruction, but a kind of life itself. The Imam said that the reason why human beings are scared of death is that they are attached to this world and their belief in the hereafter is weak. He called the time of death as the time of witnessing because the signs of the next world are visible at the time of death. In other words, when death comes, our eyes are opened to see the superior and unseen world. Imam Khomeini maintains that the hardships of the moment of death have their roots in our attachments to this world and its pleasures. Therefore, if we were indifferent toward the world and its pleasures, we would be happy at the time of departure of the spirit from the body. The last days and hours of the life of Imam Khomeini proved his beliefs in death and the hereafter. All those who were with the Imam in the final days of his life have said that they had seen interesting scenes. Imam Khomeini's younger son, late Hajj Ahmad, was with the Imam in the last days of the Imam's life. He relates an interesting memory of the last day of Imam Khomeini's life. This shows the calm that the founder of the Islamic Republic had. Hajj Ahmad said, "The last day was 13th of Khordad. The physicians were disappointed. I went to the Imam's room. His face was luminous as he was performing prayer. He was engaged in praying since the night before, that is, 10 p.m. of the previous day. As he was lying, due to the low blood pressure, he would raise his head with difficulty in order to perform genuflection and then prostration. I wanted to speak to him, but I couldn't because I didn't like to disturb the spiritual atmosphere. I just looked at him for a while and left the room. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, his health deteriorated and the devices began working. Then, at 10 at night, the Imam passed away."
Around the world with reporters.
Public outpouring against Israel in Pakistan. The streets of the mega city of Karachi flooded with protesters in solidarity with Palestinians. There is no letter to anti-Israel protest in this 220 million populated Muslim country after Israel attacked and desecrated Islam's third holiest site in the eastern Jerusalem al-Quds and imposed a unilateral war on Gaza. The huge collateral and human losses in the latest round of one-sided war imposed on unarmed Palestinians has once again become a rallying point to unify people from all segments of the society in Pakistan to join hands to protest against Israel.
We thank to Allah. Today, people in every Muslim country stand by Palestinians. And by God willing, we would continue our war against Israel until we liberate Al-Quds Mosque.
The anti-Israel protests have been swelling in Pakistan despite a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas administration in Gaza. Pakistan's government is feeling the heat of public pressure, which is reflected in country's foreign minister's rare and blunt remarks about Western media outlets on how they have been whitewashing war crimes of Israel against Palestinians.
Israel is losing out. They're losing the media war despite their connections. They are losing the media war. The tide is turning.
What are their connections?
Deep pockets.
What does that mean?
Well, they're very influential people. I mean, they control media.
I would call that an anti-Semitic remark.
Pakistan has rejected criticism of pro-Israeli lobbies and Western media, claiming that country's foreign minister's remarks were anti-Semitic. On the contrary, foreign minister's analogy about nexus between Israel and Western media has been welcomed across the Muslim world. Islamabad says the Western media has been covering up the massacre of Palestinians by propagating it as Israel's right of self-defense. On the other hand, whenever leaders of the Muslim countries speak truth about Israel's aggression and apartheid state's overgrown influence on Western media to whitewash its war crimes, they call it anti-Semitic. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Bishop Talbot Swan, a highly respected civil rights activist, expressed the sympathy and solidarity among the African American community for the Palestinians as outrage over Israel's actions has continued to grow.
If any people should resonate with what's going on in Palestine, it's black people in America. Even when we look at what's happening on the streets in our nation, many police departments across America actually go to Israel to be trained by the military in so-called counterterrorism strategies. And then they come here into black communities and employ those strategies on black citizens. So we fully understand their struggle. It resonates with us, and we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
For many, the fact the U.S. government funds Israel while reparations owed to black Americans have yet to be paid is hypocritical.
They can find nearly $4 billion a year to give to Israel, but they can't find any money to give to African Americans who descended from enslaved Africans. It's a travesty. It's a shame. And we're not asking for a handout. We're not asking for you to do us a favor. That's money that is owed. That's a debt that the United States has yet to pay.
Like many faith leaders, Bishop Swan reiterated his continued support for the Palestinians in the face of racist apartheid.
Oppressed people all over the world are watching what's happening. We are standing in solidarity with you. We are pushing and pressing for governmental structures to condemn the violence, to stop the funding of terrorism, because that's exactly what it is, and we want them to remain steadfast, to be strong, and to know that we are behind them.
The demands for the U.S. to stop funding Palestinian oppression and to implement justice for black America will continue as long as the status quo remains in place.
Support for the Palestinians has undoubtedly intensified, with millions of people around the world condemning Israel, demanding an end to the occupation of Palestine. Richard Sudam, London.
With less than a month to go until the presidential election in Iran, people are discussing about the policies the next president must follow to solve the problems. Out of over 400 contenders, about 40 heavyweight ones claim their number one goal is to solve economic problems that have been growing during the past years. In order to see how these plans are feasible, we talked to some lawmakers regarding the objectives every hopeful must have in mind.
In every election, the economy is of great significance to people, especially at a time they've experienced tough times in the face of economic issues. Hopefuls make promises, but people must be watchful not to pin hope on their slogans. Their slogans must have a logical basis. In my opinion, what the country needs in terms of economy is a look at international capabilities. Of course, the sanctions are biting, but we can't say all our economic problems are because of the sanctions. Most of our economic issues are the result of not paying attention to domestic capabilities.
Another lawmaker told us the most important things the president must follow are transparency and accountability.
People expect the runners to be honest with them. They say the next president must have a comprehensive plan for the economic issues. It means the result of their plans must be seen in the economic basket of the families. Within the past 8 years, the government was waiting for decisions to be made outside the country. The next president should fight against corruption and injustice.
The MPs stressed that having good relations with the world for economic improvement is a must, but each country should rely on its own capabilities.
The livelihood of people and solving economic problems is the main slogan of most of the hopefuls for the 13th presidential election of Iran. They also say that they have detailed plans to improve the life quality of people. Human Abedi, Tehran.
For the second week in a row, a march in Paris for Palestine has been banned by the French authorities. The only authorized demonstration was a static gathering, but these restrictions had at least one positive outcome. It temporarily unified a broad spectrum of organizations. Trade unions, political parties, and many associations demonstrated all together against the Israeli war crimes and in favor of the Palestinian resistance. Long time not seen. The protesters also blamed the complicity of French President Macron with the Israeli war crimes.
It's totally hypocrisy. The French government does not condemn the colonization and the ethnic cleansing in Jerusalem. The French government only condemns Palestinians when they defend themselves. Now there is a generalized outrage of all the Palestinians in Gaza, in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, in occupied cities since 1948, and in the refugee camps. Today, all these organizations act together to support the Palestinian resistance.
Many protesters salute the recent ceasefire concluded between Israel and Hamas, but they say it's a very temporary and partial ceasefire.
We're all happy about the ceasefire, but this doesn't fix all remaining problems. The colonization of Palestine by Israel has to be stopped. The political prisoners have to be released, and the apartheid policy has to end. It's a shame for the entire world. Macron said that Israel has the right to defend itself. It's a scandal. You don't defend yourself by killing children.
French President Macron indeed condemned the rockets fired by Hamas by saying that Israel has the right to defend itself. At the same moment, entire families and children died in Gaza under the Israeli bombs. His statement scandalized a lot of people.
We all want sanctions against Israel, divestment and a boycott of Israeli products so that pressure will increase to stop the colonization of the Palestinian territories. We denounce the complicity of the French government with Israel. France is not putting any pressure on Israel. Even worse, France collaborates with Israel economically and militarily.
The international NGO Human Rights Watch called the policy of Israel against the Palestinian population apartheid. These are strong words and a reference to the South African apartheid system decades ago. That system has been overcome by international pressure. Time to do the same with Israel.
The organizers here demand concrete sanctions against Israel from the French authorities and from the European Union. Chris Den Hond, Paris.